is lecture number 6. We're still talking about quantization of constrained systems. I reviewed the last transparency 3.5, or which we stopped in the middle. According to the Dirac prescription, you should quantize first. We follow that. We take the classical constraints, promote them to quantum operators. The phase space variables P and Q become operators capital P, capital Q, and the operators become a suitable self-adjoint combination of those. We focus on the sum of the squares of those operators and observe that if phi was in the eigenspace of 0 for all of these operators, it's certainly in the eigenspace of the square of those and the sum, and vice versa, that this single condition is equivalent to all of these conditions. You can test that by taking the expectation value with the same state. That's a sum of positive terms, each of which has to be 0, which implies that. However, we're going to extend the Dirac prescription as follows. We're going to introduce a projection operator, which has traditional projection operator properties, E equals E squared equal E adjoint. And our projection operator is going to be that the sum of these squares is not 0. We're not focusing on the 0 eigenspace, but it's going to be a small window around near 0, so that some of those squares should be less than or equal to delta squared in terms of the spectral family of projection operators associated with the self-adjoint. This is the integral of that spectral family from 0 up to delta squared. And our physical Hilbert space will be this projection operator times the original Hilbert space as a regularized physical Hilbert space, and our final step is going to be to reduce that delta appropriately. We talked about two basic examples, and we quickly review those. The sum of the J squared for the rotation group should be less than H bar squared over 2. That's equivalent to saying that only spin 0 can appear, and therefore JK equal to 0 for all the Ks. The constraints in this case are P and Q, P squared plus Q squared less than H bar. You recognize that as a harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian. And I've arranged it to select, for example, the ground state when those are irreducible situations. So this is a non-empty statement. Example 1 is an operator, sum of the J's, which has a discrete spectrum which includes 0. That's the first class situation. The second one is also a discrete spectrum which excludes 0, and that's the second class criteria. Now, we come to the new material for the day. The projection operator for an operator whose 0 lies in the continuous spectrum, for example, Q squared less than delta squared. And we talked about the two issues there. that the expectation value will go to 0, but if we divide by appropriate rescaling factor, we can bring that expectation value away from 0. However, that limit will exist only in certain cases when the function is continuous. Can we do better? And here comes the idea of the reproducing curl, which we talked about in our last lecture. And it's 3-4, I believe, the page on which that's described. So a more careful way to proceed is the following. Let's use coherent states to take a form limit. A form limit is a limit of an operator. However, it's between fixed bras and fixed kets. You can have both. You need both of the left vectors and the right vectors to be under your control. Okay, so we're going to take that limit here, and we're going to multiply it by a factor. Well, in particular, we're actually dividing it by this factor. But you remember we talked about reproducing kernels and what happens when you multiply them by a constant. Finite constant multiplication of reproducing kernel produces a Hilbert space which is identical in the set of functions with the previous Hilbert space. The only thing that is different is the so-called inner product. Well, here is the definition of this numerator, which is the integral from minus delta to plus delta, diagonalizing the operator Q to the X bra and ket, and this limitation between Q squared less than or equal to delta squared is the limit. Integration is limited between minus delta and plus delta. And similarly for the denominator. And this becomes our replacement for the two delta we had before. And as delta goes to zero, the numerator squeezes down to the value at x equals to zero, the overlap of the coherent state vector at the point x equals zero, divided by the coherent state vector evaluated at the zero, zero argument down in the denominator. And for this function to make good sense, all we need is a continuous fiducial vector. You don't have to worry about the continuity of the function that we had in the previous case. Okay, point is that by this prescription, by this rescaling of a, by a suitable amount and taking the limit, we have come up with a new reproducing kernel, a new function, positive, definite. It's a function of positive, definite type. And that makes a reproducing kernel. Therefore, it engenders, it creates its own Hilbert space. And in this particular case, this is going to be a Hilbert space for a one-dimensional physical Hilbert space. One-dimensional because you take linear combinations, those linear combinations appear over here, and then every element in the Hilbert space will be proportional to that single function. Let's make a rough graphical summary of where we are with these three examples. I'm plotting here projection operator. Schematically, that the higher you up vertically are, that's a larger projection operator. Going down, it's going down towards the zero projection operator. Delta is on the horizontal axis. Delta is small at the left side and large on the right side. The first example we talked about was the case of the rotation group. And that had the feature that as delta got small, it would home in, it would decide, it would choose the zero spin representation. And we could actually go all the way down to delta equal to zero, because that zero was a discrete state contained within the spectrum at zero. Case number two was our p squared plus q squared situation. That was our second class example. And as for large delta, we could capture a lot of states of that harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian. As we march down, we would get to fewer and fewer states. And if we got below h-bar, there would be no states left. So that would disappear, and we'd have a vanishing projection operator here. So that's characteristic, crude graph to be sure, characteristic of what happens in the case number two, example number two. And example number three, which was the continuous spectrum situation, even as we got smaller and smaller in delta, we had an infinite dimensional Hilbert space still there between these finite limits of delta. And when we got down toward delta equals zero, we had to bring up a magnifying glass, that's this thing on the left here, which is to enlarge what's going on, and that's our division here by this vector, which is getting smaller. Okay. 3.7, we have an operator identity. A very important operator identity. Which says we have an integral representation for our projection operator. Here is our projection operator one more time. The sum over the squares of the constraints, operators themselves, going to be less than or equal to some small parameter, which we call delta bar, squared, and often depends on h bar. And that's given as a functional integral, time-ordered integration involved, suitable measure curly dr of lambda, and the integrand is an integral involved, I've set h bar equal to 1 here, involving lambda alpha, the Lagrange multipliers, and the constraints themselves phi alpha dt. Well, that seems reasonable enough, but here's the miracle. The R of lambda depends, what can it depend on? It depends on A, that's the number of constraint operators we have. It depends on the time interval, T2 and T1 here. It depends on delta squared, because that has to be out here, but it does not at all depend on the choice of the constraints. This is an operator identity. In fact, I could choose all of the phis to be zero. All of the phis equal zero. What does that say? If the phis are all zero, then this term is missing. All we have, there's no time order thing to worry about. All we have now on the right is the integral of dr of lambda, if you will, the weight of that measure. On the left side, we have zero less than a positive number. Well, that's true on every vector in the Hilbert space. So this becomes the identity operator equal the integral of dr of lambda. That tells us the magnitude of that measure. That measure is integral equal to 1. We'll come back to that a little bit later when we compare it with the Fadeyev story. Okay. How can that integral representation be helpful to us? Well, we can put it inside a path integral construction. Here is a path integral construction rather like what Fadeyev offered to us in his approach. It has the classical action here. I've restored the h bar on this side, but not that. Oh, there it is on this side. Good. Okay. Pj, Qj dot for the kinematic term, minus the Hamiltonian, minus the Lagrange multiplier, the classical constraints, integration over the p's and the q's and the Lagrange multipliers. But we don't use the Fadeyev measure. He had a flat measure, a measure without the r, if you will, which has an integral of an infinity. Who said that the Lagrange multiplier had to enter the path integral with a flat measure? Well, if you wish to enforce the classical constraints, delta functional will emerge from that, of course. That's what you want to use. But I say let's enforce the quantum constraints. And all I do, formally, is to change the nature of the measure from d flat lambda to dr lambda. And what do I get over here? By a suitable definition of what you mean by the right-hand side, I get the coherent matrix elements of, you're living in the physical Hilbert space, the projection part here, and the Hamiltonian that is propagating in you in here is the subpart of the original Hamiltonian given by a projection operator on each side. That is the appropriate propagation quantity in the reduced classical, reduced quantum Hilbert space. And this formula is valid for first and second class constraints. It doesn't matter about that. Let's make a comparison of this kind of formula, this kind of method, with the traditional methods that some of you, perhaps the more advanced of you, are familiar with. Traditional methods involve gauge fixing. They involve the Fadeyev-Popov determinant and what goes along with it, the Grieboff ambiguity. We have no gauge fixing in this prescription. We have no Fadeyev-Popov determinant and, therefore, not a surprise, we have no Grieboff ambiguities coming. Traditional methods use auxiliary variables. For example, the ghosts. They will introduce ghosts to do certain tricks for them, or ghosts of ghosts sometimes, but we have no auxiliary variables at all. Direct brackets appear in the traditional formalism because they want you to eliminate the second class constraints. We don't need to do that. We don't need to eliminate the classical constraints. And I thought of a couple more good expressions here that belong with the dot, dot, dot. There's no moduli space. You're supposed to get the moduli space on the left hand in the traditional methods. That's the space where every point corresponds to a true, physically distinct situation. We don't care about that. That's a hard thing to do, by the way. Also, over here, they will often use indefinite metrics. Never appears with the projection method. I say it has some advantages. Let us tack two additional problems in the rest of today's lecture, two advanced examples. I gave you three basic examples before. We're now going to talk about two rather advanced examples. Now, they're not hard at all. One of them is just a single degree of freedom. But I challenge you to come up with an equivalent treatment of these two problems by other method. So this is cutting edge material right now. Let's take a classical system, which is pq dot minus lambda, and the constraint here is q cubed times 2 minus q. So here it is over here. That's the constraint. I vary the equation of motion lambda to get the constraint, which is q cubed 2 minus q. So that has two solutions, q equals 0 and q equals 2. So there's two points in the q space. Maybe I draw that on the blackboard here. Here's the classical phase space. Here's q equals 0 and q equals 2.
which are singled out by the constraint.
Now, let's vary the other variables. Vary p, and you get q dot equals 0. Vary q, and you get the equation p dot equals, as given here, minus 3 lambda q squared.
You can read the rest.
Let's solve those classical equations of motion. Q of t, of course, q dot is 0, so q of t is equal to its initial value, but that initial value has to satisfy the constraint. That means it can only be 0 and it can only be 2. So there's two possible values for q.
They're frozen at 0 or 2. Take your choice.
P of t, on the other hand, has this Lagrange multiplier on the right-hand side, which I don't know, but I will invoke it in my solution, so I do integrate the right-hand side. I get p of 0, the initial starting point. Q is fixed because of the equation above, and so I get the integral of the Lagrange multiplier up to t plus the second term, q cubed, 0 to t of the Lagrange multiplier. So, that's my solution. Now let's look at them individually. When q can be either its value 0 or q could be its value 0. So here, value 2. Here is q 0 equals 2. When q 0 equals 2, I beg your pardon, q of 0 equals 0. When it's 0, that term is a 0 coefficient. That term is a 0 coefficient. So nothing appears here, and p of t is strictly p of 0. Q of t, of course, is always its initial value, q of 0, which is 0. When q of t equals 2, then this term disappears because of that, but this term does not disappear. That becomes 8 times the integral up to t of lambda t prime, etc. Therefore, the p value at q equals to 0 is insensitive to the Lagrange multiplier. That means it's inobservable. Whereas the p value when q equals 2 is completely sensitive to lambda, so that means it is a non-observable.
It's a gauge-dependent quantity, whereas the former one is not.
Therefore, our two little pieces of phase space, these two wiggly lines I have here on the blackboard, p and 0, which is the lower horizontal line, p and 2, which is the higher horizontal line, the p value in the first one is gauge-independent. The p-value for the second one is gauge-dependent. The constraint at q equal 2 is called regular. Regular because it vanishes linearly when at the constraint point. The constraint at q equal 2 is called an irregular constraint. It does not vanish linearly at the constraint point. It vanishes like a cube. And that q means it does not appear in this situation when q equals 0.
Okay. How do we treat that problem by the projection algorithm?
Here's our basic rule. We have only one constraint, q squared, 2 minus q. Quantize it, square it. So I come q to the 6, 2 minus q, quantity squared, less than or equal to delta squared. H bar is not important at this point. This is a constraint whose zeros lies in the continuum, so we'll just take delta squared by itself. This constraint is, of course, equivalent to this. I'm sorry, this projection operator is equivalent to this projection operator, taking the original constraint between plus and minus delta. In fact, that's the reason we call this delta squared, so we can often go to this one. Let's observe that since the variable q lies in the continuum, it actually adds nothing to either include or not include the endpoint here, because that's a set of measure 0 in the integration space. So we can also say that this is the same as q cubed times 2 minus q less than delta and greater than minus delta strictly. Let's now imagine delta to be a very, very small parameter. We're eventually going to take it to 0, so we're almost there. When delta is extremely 0, two things can happen. If q is near 0, then this is the only important part of this problem, 2 times q cubed. That's when e is near 0. And when q is near 2, then the only import of that problem is q near 2, and for that, the q, the second q, the q cubed, can be replaced by 2. So that's 2 cubed becomes 8. So we have broken it into two different projection operators, one near 0 and one near 2. Finally, we can recognize that this projection operator around 0 can be written as q less than and greater than something else. And that something else in this case will be delta by 2 to the 1/3 power. On the other hand, we have a second projection operator here, q less than and greater than something else, and that something is now 2 plus delta 2, 2 minus delta 2, and that delta 2 just accounts for that silly factor of 8 that's there. So he wrote the problem down into the sum of two independent projection operators. Moreover, not only are they independent, as we will stress, and we will now use in a minute or two, the fact that they are orthogonal projection operators. Because what's important here is that here this is q near 0, this is q near 2. They don't have any overlap with one another. Okay. So, let's use our coherent state trick to make reproducing granules. So we take E0 and E2, which were on your previous transparency, bring up canonical coherent states, P and Q on the right and on the left as well, make matrix elements out of that, which gives us a reproducing kernel, because this is certainly a positive definite quantity we're taking out. And actually, it's the sum of two terms, and we'll make use of that straight away. We'll call the first one K sub 0, because that's where Q is effectively 0. The second one K sub 2, because that's where Q is essentially equal to 2. So we have two reproducing kernels here. That sum adds up to our overall one. The fact that E0 times E2 vanishes, the projection operator on this little interval times the projection operator on this little interval have nothing in common, can be used as follows. Let's integrate K0 against K2 using the resolution of unity that exists between them. So, resolution of unity allows us to bring the E0 and E2 together, which are part of this, but E0 times E2 vanishes. So this is, the result of this is the matrix element, off-diagonal matrix element of 0, hence this whole integral is 0, that these two kernels are orthogonal to each other. Good. So we have a reproducing kernel which I want to massage, I want to change, I want to exploit this delta trick, namely taking the delta towards a small parameter in a well-designed way. I know I want to arrange it so that it gives me something both at 0 and at 2, because that's where the classical constraints say I have something happening. That's also where the quantum constraints say I have something happening. I want to introduce a particular function, capital A. That function is a weighted modification of our K0 plus K2. In particular, it has a square root divided by an E0 E0 expectation value in the coherent state at 0.00, and it has the second term with a square root E2 expectation value in the state is 0, 2. This is where Q equals 2 in here. That's where the action is in that part of the problem. I throw in extra coefficients A and B, both of which are positive. You'll see why in a little bit. But I just want to demonstrate that the results we get out of here, the principal results, will be actually independent of the A and B. This is like, it will turn out to be a similarity transformation in things, but let me not jump the gun a little bit. So my A is a carefully chosen helping function. I use that A to define a new reproducing kernel. I take the original kernel we were given by the problem, integrate with capital A on the right and capital A on the left in appropriate fashion. That this one over here is the complex conjugate of that one. That makes this new function also a function of positive type. That means it generates or acts like a reproducing kernel. Therefore, it will generate its own Hilbert space. And that Hilbert space will be the same set of functions that we had originally here, because I'm only making finite modifications of things. The inner product, however, will be different. Okay, so what is that integral with the two a's done for me?
That k, remember, was equal to k0 plus k2. The k0 term will filter out the k2, will only accept the k0 term, and square that coefficient so I get an a.
I get the original k0 divided by the square of this term, which is appropriate for its rescaling. Likewise, for the k2 situation, the k2 part of this will filter out the k0, leaving me only this by all by itself, so I get the square of the square root of b, which is b, and divide by the appropriate square of that denominator. So this now becomes my new kernel of interest, designed by care, by what I thought, in order to focus on 2 and focus on 0. Now we're going to take the limit delta to 0. Delta to 0 will yield me a new reproducing kernel, as it did in the third example. Remember, q squared less than or equal to delta squared. But what's happening is that I'm giving a different weighting to each of the terms. This term vanished like q cubed, so it has a very special kind of reweighting compared to the second term, which only vanished linearly. Okay. Nevertheless, the result of taking delta to 0 yields another reproducing kernel we'll call k tilde, which is given, very much like in our q squared story, by inserting the resolution for the q variable, which is the x's, and saying we're going to focus on the 0 value, which is here, divided by the same thing we had before. And over here we have the 2 and the 2 situation. So we have one for each of our regions in the phase space where the constraint has vanished. Here we have two linearly independent functions. And when I take linear combinations of this reproducing kernel, I will generate a two-dimensional Hilbert space. Well, I have two dimensions I want to worry about. Okay. Now, I think the next slide and a half will be the most informative and interesting. Let's specialize to some particular coherent states. It really doesn't matter. The coherent states are free to choose. We want them to be having a continuous fiducial vector so we don't get in trouble with our evaluations at x equals 0 or 2. But let's take the ground state of the harmonic oscillator because that's easy to work in analytic terms. Here's our form for the coherent states we'll take. And so I now put into the previous equation the very definition of the coherent states, and I can now evaluate them. And I have the two terms, one from the case that q equals to 0, which looks like the top line here, and then the bottom line is the case from q equals 2. How do I read out of those expressions that I have actually arrived at capital Q equal to 0, or capital Q equal to 2? Here is how capital Q appears in the coherent state. In this first term, there is no dependence on P. There's no dependence on P prime and P double prime. The P has vanished from this first equation. That means its coefficient has had to vanish itself. Capital Q acts like 0 because the little p is absent from the expression. In the second term down here, little p is present, but it's actually coming in as a phase factor just like this, and it's coming in such that capital Q equals 2 right there, and there's the 2. And that tells you that on this second space, we have arrived at a situation where the capital Q is equal to 2. Okay. This is our function for the reproducing kernel. Play the game we did abstractly on 3-4, and you will get the reproducing kernel Hilbert space that goes with it. This is the physical Hilbert space of the reduced system. But I want to go a little bit further and do something new. I want to introduce the concept of observables and then take the classical limit of this expression. Here is h bar. Here is h bar. There is an h bar in the theory. I want to remove h bar, let h bar go to 0, and show you
that we can recover the fact that this describes the classical theory where q equals 0 and q equals 2. So what are observables in this physical Hilbert space?
Here's the defining equation. Observables should commute with the projection operator. Well, suppose I don't have an operator which commutes with it. I have an operator G. And I want to extract from G, I want to take out of G the part that is observable. All I need to do is to take the Hermitian G and make a new Hermitian operator by putting a projection operator on each side of it. We'll call that G with a superscript E, indicating that we've made it this way. This is, if you will, the observable part of G. It obviously will satisfy the criterion above it. For the momentum operator capital P, the observable momentum operator in the reduced physical Hilbert space, we'll call P super E, that's the capital E on each side of P. And similarly for the coordinate, capital Q, we'll put an E on each side of that, and that will become our observable component of the position operator. Let's start with an easy case. Let's take the classical momentum here, find the classical momentum. Well, the first thing we do is we take the diagonal coherent states. You remember long ago, we talked about the relation of the diagonal coherent states to the classical story. They didn't quite give us the true classical argument. They gave us an H-bar augmented classical argument because H-bar was not yet set to zero. So that's our first object, is to take the classical momentum, H-bar augmented, which means take the diagonal coherent state element of the P, the observable P, which lives at E0 and at E2, two parts, and then divide by the normalization of the vector itself. And the computation will show you that the function, that average here, is P itself, just P. Not obvious, but it's P. And therefore, the limit, as h-bar goes to zero, of this h-bar augmented momentum, to give us the true classical momentum, is going to be P itself. There's no h-bar dependent, so we just get P. What does that mean? It means that the range of the variable P physical, PQ, is the same as the label P of the coherent state, which is all of R. Well, here it is. P in the classical Hilbert space goes from plus to minus infinity. You're willing to buy that, but I think the next argument will be a little bit unexpected. Let's take the classical coordinate value. So we're going to take the H-bar augmented physical position variable. Here it is, E0, QE0 for the E0 part, E2, QE2. Of course, this E is broken up into E0 and E2. The E0 parts live separately, the E2 parts live separately. So this quotient here, with the Q physical Q upstairs and the normalization in the below, gives us the computation of the physical value of the classical, I say, because it's the diagonal coherent state element, H-bar augmented of the position variable. And what is that? Not hard. Right. The denominator is the same as we've just seen before for RK, and this is 2 times B. 2, because that's the numerical value of Q at that particular point. 0 times the A, because that's the numerical value of Q at that point. So this is the dependence of the diagonal coherent state element of the physical Q in the physical Hilbert space. Now, to obtain the true classical limit, we're supposed to take the limit as H-bar goes to 0. I tell you, and if h-bar goes to 0, as this denominator here and here and here gets smaller, of course, a and e are fixed numbers, whatever they are, then the limit
will either be 0 if q is less than 1, or the limit will be 2 if q is greater than 1.
How do I show that?
I tell you, I'm trying to draw a graph here. Little q, here is 2, here is 0. Yeah, there's the 2. This is the qp up here. P and q, h bar. This is the q value. But this function is roughly like that as a function of h bar.
In short,
very far to the right, when q is large, this term is negligible compared to these, and that quotient is 2. For very far to the left, this is small compared to this. Therefore, it's something divided by a large number relative to it, so that it becomes 0.
Notice how this is answer here has been independent of the choice of A and B. A and B give you a similarity transformation among the Hilbert space. It's like taking two vectors in the Hilbert space and multiplying by one of them by 3, another by 5, that gives you a new weighting of the vector, and that would give you a new weighting of the inner product. And there's nothing wrong with that, and you can do that all the time in your quantum mechanics or in your linear algebra, but the point to observe is that the true classical limit is absolutely independent of that little quantum mechanical detail. And we've recovered the fact of 0 and 2 parameterized by that from our expression. Now, what about the point in the middle, q equals to 1? That's not there. At q equals to 1, this is e to the minus 1 squared, if you will, over h bar. They're all equal to the same thing. That quotient drops out, and the answer is 2b over a plus b. Well, if you have two regions, one is where q equals 0, one is where q equals 2, and you have a point in the middle, you're obviously going to have a discontinuity and some rule is going to be chosen to pick out the value in there, but that's a set of measure 0 with regard to the phase-space variables p and q, and if you integrated over p and q to get things, that this particular value would make no contribution. Okay. We have 7 minutes left to go through the fifth and final example for the day. This is an example with an anomaly. That means it's taken a classical first-class system and produced a quantum mechanical partially second-class system. That's actually relevant for quantum gravity. So this is a useful little example. I'll try to run through this a little more quickly. Our constraints are simply the rotation operator should be 0. Here's that line. This is the Poisson bracket between the rotation generators, as you well know. And so this is the consistency consistent. If this is 0 before, then it will be 0 after that. So these are first class closed system because the parameters of multiplication here are C numbers. And of course, this is simply the algebra. Here's the second case. Take the same story, but I'm going to multiply by a factor F given here. We'll call that RK as our new constraint there to be 0. That factor here is 1 minus alpha, constant, plus alpha times the sum of p squared and the sum of q squared divided by h bar. Well, this is the classical theory, but I want to put in a scale factor here. This is not h bar which went to 0. This is h bar equal to 10 to the minus 27, whatever it is. So I take the Poisson bracket of these for consistency, and I find that I get something proportional to R's with a phase-space factor dependent. That's called the first-class system because if the R is vanished, then the Poisson bracket vanishes, but it's an open first-class because of this term. The third example, we'll call S, has a different multiplier, G, constant. It has a P1 squared plus Q1 squared divided by H bar and a P2 squared plus Q2 squared divided by 2 H bar. And there's no P3 at all. So this has similar kinds of construction as these oscillators in these, but this is a different weighting. This is unity weighting, this is half weighting, and then there's zero weighting for the third guy. What about the quantum story? Quantum story, we'll also discuss these three examples in parallel. the C numbers go to Q numbers, which are given here, and I'm going to introduce annihilation and creation operators as a useful tool. Again, little a is Q plus I times capital P, capital Q plus I capital P, and A dagger is the I joint of that. Let's also introduce the number operator, which is the sum of the A dagger K's AK, this number of first particle type, second particle type, third particle type. Then my F multiplier, that little F, big F, 1 plus 2 alpha, 1 plus N, was the sum of all those harmonic oscillators, so it's the sum of these separate three. G, going to capital G, has this different weighting, 2 times the number 1 fellow and 1 times the N number 2 guy. Notice that the F commutes with the J, because F is fully rotationally invariant, and this asks what is your rotational character. On the other hand, G does not commute with JK, because G is not rotationally invariant. On the other hand, and very importantly, all three operators, JK, F, and G, their friends that go with them, commute with the number operator. They all have an equal number of raising and lowering operators. So let's restrict our study to a simple number operator subspace where we can make life easy. Let's go to n equals 2. N equals 2 means we have 6 vectors, two particles of type 1, of type 2, type 3. Here's a case where we have one particle of type 2, one particle of type 3, and so on. So these 6 vectors form a subspace in which we can analyze this particular problem. Okay, here is the EJ squared story, less than H bar squared. Well, you know what the spins are here. This is, we're dealing with integer spins here. The spin 1 would be, that would be 2 times this here, that's excluded. So this is the zero spin story right here. It's a vector of that, and this is the zero spin vector. I didn't choose to normalize it. It's just the sum of these three guys up there. That is the vector which is the zero sum. You remember in this 6 particle space, there's a spin 2 and a spin 1. Spin 2 and a spin 0 situation. The R case, which had the F multiplier, and the F commuted with the J's, so the RK squared is simply S squared with times the JK. You have to make a vertical line here. OR, I need to do that. I don't have my pens. But you need to finish off the second, the brow over here. Anyway, the sum of the R squared acting on OR is 0. But since the R squared is simply proportional to the JK squared with the F on the other side, OR, the ground state for that, is the same as OJ, using the same vectors we had before. Okay, easy enough. Those examples are first-class quantum because they include this vector with discrete spectrum, which does indeed have zero in the spectrum. That's the zero for which these guys are happening. Now, let's go to the interesting case. Let's put on the S guy from Modanto operators, where we have the G, which does not commute with the J, so we have to define our quantum guy in this symmetrized form. But nevertheless, the G does commute with the N state, so we can live in the two-particle spectrum. Here it is. You have to analyze this, and this is not easy. The sum of the state squares is less than h bar squared. Again, that picked out one state, OSOS. But that eigenvalue is not zero. It starts like beta to the power 6. Beta was our little coefficient here. Beta to the power 6 in h bar squared. And I'm only giving you the terms when beta is extremely small, so there are larger terms here. And the ground state associated with this, or the state that belongs to this projection operator, is not exactly the same state that was with equal weighting as these guys before. This has a 1 minus 2 beta plus a little correction, 1 minus beta plus a correction, and this. So all three enter with a different weighting. Hence, here is an example which has taken a classical system, which was the rotation operator. We've multiplied it by something to make it a little more complicated. And we saw that its classical commutator had the property of being open. That is to say, for example, this S one down here, this vanished. If S was already zero, this would vanish. But it's a very complicated, I didn't even bother to write it down for you, phase-space-dependent coefficient. That has become
complicated in the quantum theory when, in this last case, it didn't commute, and it has caused a first-class system to become partially second-class. When we discuss quantum gravity, which will be done in a gentle way for you in the next two lectures, then you will see that this is a problem that quantum gravity faces. First class classically, second class quantum mechanically. And I'm showing you how the projection operator method can actually handle such methods problems. Thank you. And I especially bring to your attention, today we have great cookies. But we're not going to finish all two cans.
Questions or
questions? The first transparency of the next lecture is an entire complete discussion of the electromagnetic field. Sorry?
You do QED and long transparency.
Sure. why take more when you don't need it? I think about absolutely. Of course, it's ACE, it's ACE, their standard.
But can you still do perturbation
theory? That's under intensive investigation at the moment. I would love to believe that we will be able to overcome that, but I personally, machine, do our stuff. I better cut this off here.